Let's start with a bit of mechanics in lab. So we have two time periods, the lab lecture and the lab itself that we're supposed to be meeting in here for. Section one, their lab lecture was 7:30 to 8:20, and then the lab from 8:20 to 10:10. This section, the lab lecture is from 11:30 to 12:20, and then your lab is from 12:20 to 2:10. The reason it ends at 2:10 instead of 2 o'clock is we have built in a break time. So after the lab lecture, even if I forget to announce it, you're free to disappear for 5 minutes or so as part of your break that we're supposed to give you, given how long the class is. So again, if I forget to announce it, you do have that opportunity. For lab lecture, we're normally going to discuss theory, which since most of you are returning students, you already know the warning that's going to go along with this, which is that I will talk about theory in the lab lecture, and that will be the material that the lab quiz is based on. You do have the experiment itself that you're going to perform, but usually the experiment itself is not going to be the subject of the lab quiz. There may be some notable exceptions. So for example, in one reaction last quarter, we had a series of washes. There was bisulfite, bicarbonate, and a sodium chloride wash. And so even though those were procedure steps, I did ask, why did you use those particular washes? But it was because we did cover that information as part of the lab lecture. So for the new people, the mistake that the returnees always make is that they get all worried about the lecture quizzes and exams, because they are much tougher than the lab quizzes. The lab quiz, in fact, is straight from the lab lecture. But I will describe in a moment something called a pre-lab, which is something you have to have prepared for the lab lecture. That pre-lab only covers procedure, not theory. And so what inevitably happens is that people get the procedure part read and completed, because that's what you need to be in lab. But since theory is not required at that time, then there's a lot of justification that goes on. Like, oh, well, I've got bio tomorrow. Oh, I've got this. Oh, I've got that. And so around about the middle of the quarter, when the lab quiz actually comes around, you'll see an awful lot of tension suddenly appear. Because suddenly everybody thinking, oh, I better go back and study the whole half quarter's worth of lab notes to make sure I'm ready in time. Which makes it even tougher if you're studying things like NMR, as we will continue studying this quarter. So we will go over, in fact, the lab quizzes from last quarter, because all three sections had different NMR problems. So we have 6 NMR problems to review as practice. But so in lab lecture, what will normally happen is if we have a new experiment that's beginning, there'll be a pre-lab check. And I'll describe that pre-lab in a moment. We'll then go over theory. We'll go over procedure. And then the next hour is when you have your chance to actually perform the experiment. There'll be 2 lab quizzes for the quarter, one right in the middle of the quarter, and then one the day we check out, 11 weeks from today. So at De Anza, there is a finals week, but there is class that meets that first day of finals week. And since it's a Monday, and since this is a Monday class, we do meet that last day. So now about those pre-labs. Why is it that you have to do a pre-lab? Main reason is safety. And in fact, there's 2 things extra, little but important things, I want you to put in to your pre-lab. First, let me give you the general description of a pre-lab. And then I can get back to why is it that we do it. The reason we do a pre-lab is because normally when you go in to do an experiment, you don't have it nicely laid out for you, already written out with all the correct glassware and quantities of chemicals. Even if you're doing exactly the written experiment, you might be doing it at a different scale. Or in real life, many things don't go exactly the way that they're written, and so you might have to make minor adjustments to a procedure, particularly if you're using it on a different molecule than had been used previously. And so any real researcher generally comes up with a design lab procedure that they'll themselves write out, either literally write, or of course there are electronic texts or lab books these days. But in other words, they don't just sit there in lab and refer to this book. They've already done the work ahead of time, and so that they're efficient when they come to lab. So the general format for the this is the section that I need to do this with. moment, since for the lab, pre-lab, that's pretty simple. I'll just put that on the board. Pre-lab format can be as simple as this, where you have a two-column format. The left-hand column is procedure. The right-hand column is for data. In terms of procedure, unless otherwise stated, we will always do the mini-scale procedure. There's mini-scale and micro-scale. We'll almost always ignore the micro-scale, which is the second of the two procedures. So, for example, your first lab is the aldol condensation. And the theory for that was on pages 617 through 619, and then the lab itself, the procedure, was on 619, just a touch, and 620. And that's just the mini-scale procedure, though. Immediately afterwards is the micro that we're skipping. Heads up, we'll likely do reduced quantities to save on chemicals. So wherever it lists an amount, you might want to leave a little bit of space. I did not have a chance yet to duck into the stockroom to find out what that factor is that we'll reduce by. But during lab lecture, I will, of course, be sure to tell you. For your pre-lab, what you need to do is go through and read just the procedure part of it. The theory I want you to read, I want you to understand, but not required to be put into this pre-lab exercise. Only the procedure. And you don't copy word for word what's in the procedure. You read a step, and in whatever words you want to use, you describe that step. Because sometimes the book might give you a very long explanation of what's going on, but once you've learned what's going on, you might be able to represent that for your own self in just a sentence or two. And so you want to have just enough detail in your pre-lab that if you were to close your lab text, the textbook itself, you wouldn't need it the entire time that you're in lab. So back to the purpose part. Part of the reason you're doing this is efficiency. If you have no idea what you're doing in an experiment, it's going to take you longer to do. There's one person in section 3 who consistently has done half an hour before everybody else. And that's just because she's organized. It's not that she spends hours on her pre-lab, but she takes it seriously enough that she gets done. And so a little bit of work invested ahead of time means you get to go, well, for you all, home possibly for the day early. Aside from the efficiency aspect, the main thing is safety. And here are the two things more that I want you to put in your pre-lab versus what we did last quarter. One of them is if the book makes any specific mention of safety hazards, I want you to put those safety hazards at the beginning of your pre-lab as a mention. Then for anything that you need to dispose of, any solutions, there are three types of waste that we have in this class. We have organic waste and then acid or base aqueous waste. So organic would be anything that's organic soluble. That's pretty logical. Everything else we're going to assume is water soluble. But we have to differentiate between acidic and basic solutions because we can't store those or dispose of those together because of the potential to have an adverse reaction. So wherever your procedure says to dispose of something, you need to notate, does it go in acid waste, basic waste, or acidic waste? Now, instead of making a separate category, separate column, you could just put a big letter A, B, or O, acid, base, organic, next to wherever in the procedure that comes up. So instead of making a yet another separate entity that you're writing up, you could just do your pre-lab, but everywhere where it mentions getting rid of aqueous waste or whatever kind of waste, you put that A, B, O designation. So you know where the waste should go. So that's pre-lab, and I'll transfer that to the page that I'm going to put the notes on momentarily. Any questions about the pre-lab, what you need to do? So again, it's just a retelling of the procedure in your own words with just enough detail that you'd be able to do it without the lab text. Again, you don't have to include anything about theory, but you do have their pre-lab due on Wednesday, since we will begin our experiment on Wednesday. So as I had stated in class, there's a few items that you need to have, and that's my way to segue into lab safety. First one, of course, is goggles. And we don't have goggles we provide for you to take, so you will need to get your own pair. Of course, most of your returning students already have them, but if you don't have them, need to get them by Wednesday. The bookstore should have them. And you can get them from other places, but if you do, as I had cautioned you in lecture, make sure that you get chemical safety goggles. The other things you'll need, of course, appropriate lab clothing, which the one item that people had the most difficulty with last quarter were shoes. And I understand that there's lots of stylish shoes, lots of comfy shoes, lots of not appropriate for lab shoes, though. So the only type of shoe that you have should have exactly one hole, the one hole that your foot goes in to get into the shoe. Now, if you've got some fancy dress shoe where the top of your shoe is, there's barely any shoe and it's all just showing the top of your foot, not good for lab, not appropriate lab attire, because you're, think of it this way, the only reason we get so obsessed about shoes is that your feet stick out and things fall down. So if things fall down and your foot sticking out, it's gonna land on your foot. So if you had, for example, a solid pellet of sodium hydroxide, you may not feel that right away when it gets in your foot, because sodium hydroxide has just got a slippery kind of feel to it. And without being too disgusting, you know, if it's a really hot day and you have sweaty feet, that might feel slippery just by its own self, right? But a couple hours later, when you've got that pellet of sodium hydroxide on your foot, it has eaten away the few top layers of your skin. It's saponified, which is one of the first reactions that we're going to learn this quarter. So, and you got this really, really nasty chemical burn, all from just something that's simple, quote unquote, like sodium hydroxide. You're using the nastiest chemicals you've used at the ends of this quarter. So safety never didn't matter, but matters even more now. So when I tell you these safety things, I'm hoping that you listen. I hope you particularly listen when I get to my pet peeves in a moment. So your shoes, again, the reason we're so worried about your shoes is so that you don't get anything stuck and then therefore reacting on the top of your feet. By similar logic, that's why we are worried about what you wear in terms of skirts or pants, not as concerned about what you wear up top, although certain industries might be. As far as down below, you need to have jeans, slacks, sweats, track pants, whatever that goes down to your ankles. Again, the coverage idea, that your ankles are the things that are the furthest down and that the most likely for something to fall or spill onto in terms of gravity working. So that's why we have this requirement that has to go all the way down, not just below your knees, but down to your ankles. Now, I know that can get a little bit less convenient when the weather starts getting nicer and nicer and nicer. Some of you have habit to wear shorts. I had one student that no matter how cold it was, and I know that compared to the rest of the world, this is not a cold area, but no matter how cold it might have gotten, the only time I ever saw him wear pants was in lab. Otherwise, it was shorts. It could be raining, sleeting, snowing, and it was a hoodie maybe, but then just shorts. Since that's probably your preferred dress style for some of you, what I recommend is bring sweatpants, track pants, whatever to change into just for lab. That way you're more comfortable the rest of the day, but also if you're like certain people that had this happen to them, where you spill so much of something so nasty on you, you can't stay in those clothes. Well, if you don't have another pair to check into, you may be walking around just in a lab coat the rest of the day. Which you giggle, but that's what happened to one of my lab mates back at Berkeley. He spilled, I don't remember if it was acetonitrile or something, just a whole like liter thing all over him. And besides toxicity, it stank. So he couldn't stay in those clothes. Well, he had no other clothes to change into, but he couldn't stay in those, so someone went and grabbed a lab coat, and that's what he wore. So you don't want to end up in that situation. That's why it's good to have an extra set of clothes. So we talked about shoes, talked about clothes, goggles, of course. Oh, and I didn't talk about section one about this, but the ever constant battle that I have with coffee cups, which is not as bad in this section because it's the 7:30, the people that are barely clinging on to life at 7:30 in the morning that need their coffee. So they come in and you wouldn't believe the creative ways that they've gotten to walk into a room or stuff it somewhere where they think I'm not going to see it, right? Food, drink, all that stays outside here. This may be where we do lecture also sometimes, but this is a lab environment. And no, it's not that we think that the chemicals are going to, see my point right there. It's not that the chemicals are going to magically jump into there. It's that you touch the chemicals, you then touch the container, and that's how the container gets chemicals on them. Like the eyeglass example. If everybody does follow the proper way of, or constantly wearing eyeglasses, the goggles, why would we need eye wash stations? Because of lack of concentration. Because you may be thinking, oh, okay, he's the oh, no, it's about the goggles, we'll put the silly goggles on. You're working away, you're working away, you're working away, and you do this. Your eye itches, and you've just been dealing with chemicals, and you're just about to rub those chemicals in your eyes. So the two times at De Anza that I've had to use the eye wash station on students was not because of a lab accident, it's because they rubbed something in their eye. So think about that. Since I've mentioned the eye wash station, let's talk about the safety aspects of the room, things we better review. Earthquake, what do you not, besides don't panic, what do you not do in an earthquake? Why not? You never know what's on the roof that's going to fall on you, and you're going to be rushing towards doors that have glass in them. Why would you run to a potential source of broken glass? These lab benches, I'm guessing, will survive the roof collapsing on them because of how tough these benches are. So duck under the benches, wait for the shaking to stop, then go out the doors. Our main exits are the two doors, though, that have glass on them, the ones that have the exit signs. This front door is not an exit. It goes into a hallway that does have an exit on the other end of it. But if you have the building about to catch seriously on fire, do you really want to go to the interior? But you could, because you could go straight through and there's another exit back behind there that's probably not going to be used very much. And so if everything else is blocked, go out, go straight out, and keep on going. Go through that door. Otherwise, this is the best exit because there's a staircase just to the right. This staircase, or this exit you can go through as well, and then go down the ugly staircase that's over there. But that's the one that everybody will probably take in a panic, which is why I recommend this door over here instead. Wooden doors on those two sides, permanently locked. In that case, it's because of the instrument room. In that case, it's because we have balances that are particularly attractive to the drug trade. So we keep those locked up. And no, I still didn't get around to seeing Breaking Bad. I was too busy grading to really watch TV over the break. Other safety things. The two eye wash stations, the main ones are at the front and the back of the classroom. The two fire alarms are at the two exits to the classroom. The fire extinguisher is over here by the instrument room. And we have the safety shower, which my lab mate at Berkeley had to use, the same one that had to get out of the clothes, and that was the same incident that happened. I haven't had to use the shower, but it puts out an immense amount of water, and there is no drain, because why would you want to wash whatever contaminated chemicals you just got off of you down into the environment? So that's why I won't demonstrate this. There's a minor first aid kit in the stockroom, so if you have small cuts or burns or things like that, we have some Band-Aids and lotions and things. But if you have a little bit more serious injury or you're just not feeling so hot, there is the health services that I might send you to. Been lucky, have not had to call 911 yet on a student. But there is a phone here in the classroom that you don't need to dial 9 for to get out. And so if something happens, you could dial there. The one other safety note I'll mention is an optional type thing, because I'm not allowed to ask about your health information, but if you did have some pre-existing medical condition that you think you would benefit from by telling me, if only so that if something happens to you that I, as a person of authority, could go make the appropriate calls or go panic about it. If you think it would help me to know that, then optionally you may tell me. Women in the classroom, if you think you are or could be pregnant, I'm not a doctor, but I'd tell you don't be in this class, because these are the nastiest of the chemicals we deal with these three quarters, and most people who would go to a doctor would probably be told, don't take this class. So just something to consider if you find that you are ending up in that situation. Let's see. Everything else, I'm hoping that your past chem instructors have yelled at you enough times that you've got some sense. But let's now get to my pet peeves, shall we? Because part of the reason that you haven't gotten your syllabus posted yet is I'm still toying with changing the way I grade lab. Because I'm seriously considering not grading labs this quarter, but your lab technique instead. And part of that is keeping the lab environment clean. So whereas before it was just threats off of your lab report that if you didn't keep your environment in appropriate condition, it will be the sole source of your grade instead of lab reports, potentially. I'm still weighing that out. So could someone help identify for me what my two big massive pet peeves are that I'm promoting them to that level in the grading scheme? The balances. The fact that if I come over to the balances there any other day except the first day of class, they're always a wreck. Which means that we're all breathing in whatever chemicals are over there, because remember, even solids have vapor pressure. So there's solids over there right now we're being exposed to right now. How many of us are comfortable with being permanently exposed to some kind of toxin like that? Yeah, if I ask the question that way, no hands go up. And yet, how many of you know that you, your own self, have left a mess of the balance before? So explain how you could reconcile those two thoughts. There is no way to. And so therefore, it's not acceptable to. Outside of here, you'd be fired for something like that, so why should we take it easy on you here just because you're students? The chemicals are no less dangerous outside in the real world than here, right? So, at any point in the experiment, if I walk over there, any time during the lab day, and I see that it's a mess, and if I've done my job and checked it before class started, because a mess that's there before class start, I can't blame you for. But, having checked the balance when class starts, like I did today, and saw that on both of the balances, there's a minor amount of power around it. Better than most lab days, though. But if I see it any worse than that, I know you all did it, and so the points start coming off. Because if this is your last chance to have chemistry instruction here, you're going to go somewhere else and say, what the hell did they teach you there that you're acting like a pig in lab like this? Some people are not as nice as I am about telling the rules, and so you'll experience that pretty quick, believe me. What's my other pet peeve? Lids. Oh my gosh, this is the one that gets me more than anything else, because if you have something that's a lacrimer, which means if you breathe it in, you choke because it's that obnoxious. When you got something that's potentially a carcinogen, as some of the chemicals this quarter will be, which means you have a long, prolonged enough exposure to enough of the chemical, it causes cancer. Or if it's a teratogen, meaning if you were pregnant and you get exposed to this, it's going to cause fetal deformations. Now, we've got these kinds of chemicals you're going to be playing with. And so when I come along and see that someone's idea of closing this lid is to do this, this is just a waste bottle. There's ether or something else coming off of this I could smell even before I did that. So do I really want to sit here this whole time and just breathe in the fumes from this, not knowing what it is? Then what makes it better to do that with reagents like acetyl chloride? You can smell it over there, huh? Yeah, that's the point. Yeah, you're breathing it in the whole time that someone does that with a chemical that may be in that fume hood, but I bet you if I open this up, the fume hood would smell it after a while. So again, like acetyl chloride, that decomposes into acetic acid. It's enough more reactive than a carboxylic acid. It makes one when it decomposes. It'll acylate all of the OH and NH2 groups in your lining, in your respiratory passages. Not good stuff. And yet bottles will be easily left open. Explain to me the logic behind that. Logic is some of you are just too darn lazy to care, which means you don't belong in a science type job. But if I can't train that out of you, at least I can make you act responsibly for the others that are on a science track. Because really, there is nothing else besides laziness to explain it, is there? So that's what I'm grading you on. Now, whether I go back and change my mind again and throw some points in for lab reports, I probably will. We still got structure analysis we need to do. So, not unuseful. Hi.
Hi, everybody.
Yes.
Hi.
Oh, my gosh.
Barbara. Hi. Are you in the class?
I am. Okay. Can you wait just a little while until I get another break?
What time are you?
Hold on 1 second. Message understood?
Okay.
All right. So, what have I covered? Well, I talked about the essentials, what to do in an emergency, goggles, lab clothing, pre-lab. Talked about the type of lab book. We did that in a lecture, but just to remind you, for lab, you don't need any special fancy lab book just to put your results in, just a composition book. Yes, if you have the one from last quarter or two quarters or five quarters ago, if you have any free pages in it, as long as you staple the other pages together so I'm not constantly flipping through them, you can reuse a lab book from a previous quarter. And I gave you the page numbers for the first experiment, correct? How are we doing this faster than the other section did? I don't know, maybe I had more caffeine since then. But not to waste your all's time, unless there are any significant questions about lab procedure, I want to now start covering the answers to the final from last quarter. Because let me, for the new people, describe the five main types of problems that you're gonna have this quarter. First one that we're gonna cover today on the final is synthesis, where you're given some carbon starting material and you're told you may only use these starting materials as your source of carbon. And somehow you have to figure out how to transform those through multiple steps into some particular product that I designate. Another type of problem is a mechanism problem, which since there are only two of you, I'll speak to the two of you. This is a mechanism-based course. And I say that because other places that teach O-Chem, if they teach two different kinds of O-Chem, that there's generally a majors and a pre-meds version. Now, if you're in a place like Berkeley, the pre-meds version is as difficult as most places' chem majors version, so it's still mechanism-based, but there are some other places that teach I'll call it watered-down version of O-Chem that's not as heavily based on mechanism. So if that's the type of O-Chem you had, you might have a rough transition coming here, since we have had two quarters that are fairly heavy on mechanism. So second type of problem will be I'll give you a starting material, a set of reagents, and you have to write what the mechanism for that reaction is. Third type of problem is fill in the blank, where there's the reagent, the main starting platform, the reagents you're going to use, and then the product. One of the three I'll leave out, and you have to fill in the blank. So it's the fill in the blank style problem. There, there's not as much explanation, no mechanism necessary, no extended synthesis, just fill in the structure that's missing. Fourth kind of problem, theoretical. Today's lecture was a perfect example of the type of problem that could come under the theoretical category. Because we talked about two distinct reasons why the different carboxylic acid derivatives have different reactivities from each other. So when I asked that question on the quiz, which returning students already know to listen for little phrases like that, that wasn't if, that was when I asked that question on the quiz. That's a theoretical question, which there are no multiple choice exams in this class. It's all written, which grudgingly most people end up liking because at least you get partial credit that way and you get to explain yourself better that way versus just no or yes. But for ESL students, that does mean more tension, more work. And so you are allowed to bring electronic translators, but they have to be just translators. They can't be smart devices. Smart devices, you could just store the PDFs of the class on there, carry that around. So we have synthesis, mechanism, fill in the blank, theory, and number five. There will be two main types of number five. Nomenclature, these are what I call short answer. Short answer. So nomenclature falls under that, or we will be memorizing pKa values, which section one I gave a few warnings to, because they have several new students in that section, actually. I was surprised. Four or five of them. So they're not used to hearing the constant reminders that some of you tune out now, but I'll try it once for everybody and see if it works. Because I know that acid-base chemistry is something that people tend to forget. Just like if I asked you right now, how many of you could tell me what the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation is, not just what it's used for? Or how many of you could tell me what it's used for? What's a buffer solution? What is pKa? What's pKb? What is so special about the half equivalence point? Those questions I just asked, you would need to be able to explain by 6 weeks from now, because we're going to be dealing with amino acids. And any of you that have taken bio courses, you know that pH is a huge factor on the structure that collections of amino acids make. In other words, how do proteins fold depends on pH. Well, so we have to discuss pH and what changes it and what form would amino acid be in. So all that stuff I just rattled off a minute ago, you need to know and be fluent in by the time we get to that point in the quarter. So pKa values will start by the end of the week dealing with. So if you don't know what a pKa is, by Friday you need to find out what it is. If you don't, hey, doesn't change me at all. You're the one getting graded, but I gave you the warning. Then as far as the half equivalence and the Henderson-Hasselbalch and all that other acid-based goodness, 8 weeks. Got to have it relearned in 8 weeks, because then we'll be in carbohydrates and amino acids. And by then, when all anybody cares about is the summer, are you really going to have to go want to go back and relearn your Chem 1B at that point in the quarter? Whereas right now, I know every instructor is saying the same thing. You got to start the quarter off right. Oh, who cares about chemistry? This is bio. This is physics. This is math. This is college, and that's just what it's like. So you got your warning. Do with it what you want. Any questions? Shall we do that? Answering from the questions from the final now? Give me a moment just to change my setup position. For synthesis problems, if you're totally lost where to start, I always recommend looking at the carbon backbone, particularly since up to this point, we've not learned any reactions that can subtract carbons from a structure. All we've learned how to do is form carbon-carbon bonds. So the one major reaction that we have not seen yet that we should have by now is ozonolysis. So for those of you from the outset, if you already had ozonolysis, it's one of the very few reactions we didn't do and should have. That makes synthesis a lot more complicated, because you could start with 7 carbons but end up, for example, with only 6. Now, that makes me think of a question that came up last quarter. Last quarter, when we were getting into the first exam, I think, the question came up, wait, how many reactions from the quarter before do we still need to know? Same thing now. We have 12A and 12B that we've gotten out of, but we're still doing synthesis. We still need alkenes. We still need alcohols. So the same legitimate question comes up. How many of those synthesis reactions from before do we still need to know? All of them. Because it's just the third quarter of the same course. You can't think, oh, we're in a different course now. And we're just continuing the story. Does that mean I'm going to ask mechanism for all those questions? No, you did that in 12A or you did that in 12B. But if I start with an alkene and I need a less substituted alcohol, you still need to know that that's hydroboration oxidation. If I want something that is a more substituted alcohol but without rearrangement, you still need to know that's oxymercuration, demercuration. You still need to know what a hemiacetal and a hemiketal are, and what a ketal and acetal are, and the fact they're protecting groups for aldehydes and ketones. So in terms of reagents and synthesis, all of those reactions from last quarter and 12A, you still need to know. Now I'll be reviewing for everybody, but particularly for the new people, those six aspects of a reaction that I have not talked about very much recently, because we just kept getting so many reactions. But just mentioning that before we even begin, you do still need to know previous quarter's material just in the terms of being able to do synthesis problems. Not going to go back and put something on this quarter's exam that's only about past quarter material. So with all that said, let's look at the first synthesis problem. New students, I'm obsessive about charges and lone pairs. So there are instructors that do not care about lone pairs, just as there's some textbooks that don't. But I do. So if you're not used to writing your lone pairs and charges carefully, make sure you do from now on. This problem had a big, huge hint to it, which is what? What functional group is this? What functional group is it? Is this an acetal? How do we know that? Because we have two oxygens connected to the same carbon. The only five functional groups that have that are hydrates, hemiacetals, hemiketals, acetals, and ketals. Has to be one of those things to have two oxygens connected. We look and see that on each oxygen, there's an R group attached. So that means it's going to be either an acetal or a ketal. How do we tell the difference between the two? The fact that we also have a hydrogen on that same carbon where the two oxygens are joined. So once this is exposed to water and acid, it's going to decompose and make a carbonyl-containing compound. Now let's do a structure analysis. We have a 5-carbon fragment, and we have a 2-carbon fragment. Notice I haven't even written the product down yet, because that first hint about what is the functional group is even more important in this case. So let's follow that first, and then I'll show you what the product is. Because most of you who made a mistake on this problem knew what to do, but did the first step wrong. If you started with the wrong thing, it messed you up for the rest of the problem. So let's look at that 5-carbon fragment again. One end has the two oxygens connected. That's where the carbonyl used to be. Because in any of these types of reactions, making ketals or acetals, the carbonyl starts out wherever both oxygens end up.
So that means we're going to have a 5-carbon aldehyde.
What's at the other end, though? Because look around the left-hand side of what our circle. There's just an oxygen attached there, but it's on the same molecule, which means you end up with it in your product. So that is one of the products, 5-hydroxypentanal. But it's not the only thing, because there was also ethanol in that original acetal.
So these really are our two starting materials. Now, what was the given product? 6-hydroxyheptanal. Which, let's now analyze the carbon backbone. Here's that 5-carbon piece. Here's that 2-carbon piece. And, of course, we have a new carbon-carbon bond.
There's only a limited number of ways that we had learned to make carbon-carbon bonds. You could use sodium cyanide to make a nitrile. You can use an acetylide ion, alkylate and alkyne. Or, since this is 12B, more likely, a Grignard reaction or a Wittig reaction. Which of the two seems more likely in this case? Grignard, because Grignard makes carbon-carbon bonds. A Wittig reaction would not be the best choice because we couldn't control where the OH group ends up afterwards. Because there was a route that did definitely give you only one product, you did need to come up with that, which many of you did. Many of you identified this as a Grignard reaction. But what two things do we need for a Grignard reaction? A carbonyl to be attacked and a Grignard reagent. How do we know which to make out of what? Well, look where the product OH group is. Wherever the alcohol ends up is where the carbonyl started. So if the OH group ends up on the 2-carbon fragment, that means that 2-carbon fragment needs to be converted into something with an aldehyde. So we're going to do a divergent synthesis, meaning we're going to take these two materials we got from the same source, but split them into separate containers. The ethanol we're going to oxidize so we can get that carbonyl. If I only want an aldehyde, though, what oxidizing agent should I use?
PCC.
Under anhydrous conditions. That will get us ethanal, which we'll come back to later.
Look at the 5-carbon fragment. At one end, we still have the aldehyde. The other then, and though we made the new carbon-carbon bond. Well, that means we're probably going to want to back and take the alcohol from that 5-carbon fragment and turn it into a Grignard reagent. Well, we can't turn an alcohol directly into a Grignard reagent, can we? What do we need? We need an alkyl halide, because magnesium doesn't react with alcohols, it reacts with halogens.
Bromides are my default in synthesis, because they're more reactive than chlorides.
But I could have used thionyl chloride at this point. Instead, make a chloride. But once I have the bromide, can I make the Grignard reagent? Why not? Because the compound would just react with itself. You have a carbonyl on the very molecule you're trying to make the Grignard reagent from. So you have to protect it first. And you can protect it with the very alcohol that you just made up above.
So ethanol and an acid source.
We'll make another acetal. Not the original one, of course. One that has a bromine available this time. That bromine we can convert into a Grignard reagent using magnesium and ether. Recall that you have to have THF diethyl ether or something like it that can complex them with the magnesium. Otherwise, the Grignard reagent won't form.
Once we make the Grignard reagent, we throw ethanol at it. Save a little space and time. I'll then follow that up. Oh, dear. Hold on.
Well, that works for some languages. If you showed the aldehyde and that acetal Grignard reagent, and H plus all together, it's wrong. Because that means throw all the reagents together at the same time. Well, the Grignard reagent's just killed off by the H plus. So you gotta be careful in your notations. I know some of you used a shorthand where you took two arrows and stuck them together and then said H plus. But H plus has to be its own separate step after the Grignard reaction happens. What happens with that H plus? Well, two things. When the Grignard reaction first occurs, maybe I should write this in so we're not talking about something nebulous.
When the Grignard reaction first occurs, you're going to have an alkoxide. So part of the point of acid workup is
to get the product alcohol out that you want. But the acetal is also sensitive to acid in water. And so in the same step that you reprotonate the molecule, you'll also knock off the protecting group. Which means you've got the product. Now if you did protonation with a gentle acid and then used TBAF, terbutylammonium fluoride, that is not the protecting group in this case. It is H+. Questions about this synthesis? Let's go to the next one.
Thank you.
Oh, yes. Technically, instead of just H plus, we would want water. Yes. All right, now in the second synthesis, we have a 5-carbon fragment and a 2-carbon fragment. We end up with 7. So again, that's a good thing because that just means all we've done is formed a new carbon-carbon bond. Let's see if we can figure out where. Because look at the shape of that 5-carbon fragment. That is reminiscent of what's called an isoprenoid from isoprene, which is a term that you'll be familiar with at the end of the quarter when we talk cover terpenes, which are classes of biological compounds that are synthesized from structural units that look like that. If you have a bit of an imagination, you can imagine that those are two legs that some kind of head or something are walking around on. So we talk about whether things are connected head to tail, head to tail, head to head, or however. But take lots of common compounds like menthol, the stuff that gives mint its flavor, or lavanduol, the stuff that gives lavender its scent, or cholesterol, huge molecules that after multiple rounds can be generated from starting materials like that. So I'm just pointing this out because it's a structural motif we'll see later on in the quarter. But that 5-carbon fragment we can find in the product. And so it looks like we've again identified our 5-carbon fragment, our 2-carbon fragment, and so we again have identified where the new carbon-carbon bond is. So this is very similar to the previous problem, where most likely it looks like we want to do a Grignard reaction, which again means we need a carbonyl source, and again means we need a Grignard reagent. But this is a little different than the previous problem, because look at where the end carbonyl is, which that's a little strange by itself, because Grignard reactions don't make carbonyls. They make alcohols. So there had to be an oxidation that went on as well. What else is unusual? Well, that means that the aldehyde we start with is not the carbonyl that gets attacked. So we have to convert that aldehyde into a Grignard reagent. And doing so, that's how we deal with this D that's up there. So many of you knew what to do with the problem, but didn't figure out how to handle the D, deuterium. You might recall that when we talked about reduction, we talked about reduction using deuterated reagents, and there were two possibilities that can occur. One is a reduction where you use a regular reducing agent, like lithium aluminum hydride, but then followed up with deuterated acid, D+. What that will give you is an alcohol, but with a deuterium at the alcohol position, OD. Another way to do it, though, to introduce deuterium, is to use lithium aluminum deuteride, and then follow it with H+. You'll get a normal alcohol, but one that also has a deuterium on that same carbon. Exactly what you need for this problem. Look at the product and look at what we just made. We have an alcohol that we just made that we could turn into a Grignard reagent. And attack, well, attack what? We can't attack an alkene. We need a carbonyl source. So this is exactly where that concern about previous quarters material comes up. Because the only way to put an oxygen at the end, the less substituted position of an alkene like that, that we know of, hydroboration oxidation. So take the alkene, react it first with borane, then oxidize. That gets us anti-Markovnikov addition, which, again, we have to use something like PCC without water to selectively oxidize to the aldehyde. We could take, exactly as we have shown here,
ethanol, reduce it with lithium aluminum deuteride, followed by H+. That gets us a deuterated alcohol with the deuteration on carbon. Use PBr3 to make the alkyl halide, which we need because we want to make a Grignard reagent using magnesium and ether. So continuing, if we take that aldehyde, react it with the Grignard reagent we just made, we get an alkoxide first, which, if you don't know that term, alkoxide, that's the name for a negatively charged oxygen ion. React that with a dilute source of H+, so we could reprotonate the alkoxide. Then, since it's a secondary alcohol, it doesn't matter which oxidizing agent I use. But I use some form of oxidizing agent to turn that alcohol into a ketone, which means we're now at the product. Questions on that synthesis problem? Then, last thing I want to do for today is to go over the fill-in-the-blank problems, because I'm sure that those must have been of some interest as well. So first one, an epoxide reacts with something to make a combination alcohol ether. The point of this question is that there are two conditions that can be used to open up epoxides. Acidic conditions, basic conditions. And we have an epoxide that has both a primary center and a tertiary center. So remember that under acidic conditions, since it's the ring that gets protonated first and then destabilizes the rest of the molecule, attack would occur at the tertiary center under acidic conditions. But notice, the tertiary center here did not change stereochemistry. All that happened is you ended up with an alcohol because the ring had been pushed open at the less substituted position, which that only occurs under basic conditions. So that meant there was only one right answer. Sodium methoxide followed by acid workup. If you did not put your 1-2 in, then what you're saying is react sodium methoxide with H+, and the combination put with the epoxide. Since the combination would make methanol, you'd get a different product. If you did not put the H+, you need it because otherwise you're going to end up with a negatively charged molecule. You don't end up with something neutral. So you need base attack, and then you need to acidify afterwards. I'll assume there's no questions unless someone stops me, so I'm just going to keep on rolling through the rest of these. Next one. It's one I need to change for next year only because I asked too many questions about opening carbonyl derivatives.
Because notice that this is not an ester. An ester has a carbonyl, yes, and a single bond oxygen, but to the same carbon. There's one carbon in between those two things here. So this is an acetal on one side, a ketone on the other.
You react that with methyl magnesium bromide, a Grignard reagent, followed by acid and water. The point of this problem was to see whether or not you try to react the acetal,
because acetals are protecting groups against Grignard reactions. So the carbonyl, the left-hand side of the molecule, is going to react. The right-hand side's not.
So after the first step, here's what potentially we would have.
So you can see on the left-hand side, we have a new methyl group that's attacked. That's why we have the alkoxide also. Acid and heat, those conditions the acetal can't tolerate. So the acetal is going to fall apart.
And if you counted your carbons properly, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, this is an example of a 5-carbon aldehyde that has the hydroxy group at the end, but also has
a methyl and a hydroxy group one position in. So most of you have made a mistake. It was the way that you opened the ring. Now, there are not very many people that did this, so I won't show the answers per se. Some of you saw heat and acid and thought, oh, this needs to go one step further even. So if you made a hydrate, there was a note, I think, that said the product must be isolatable, and hydrates are not isolatable, not normally. Also, you might have dehydrated, but you have to be careful, because if you made an alkene on the same carbon as an alcohol, tautomerization occurs, so you got to watch out for that. Questions, or shall I keep moving on? Keep moving on, right?
Something reacts with a vitic reagent to make an alkene. Exactly what we expect.
Well, the way to analyze these in reverse is to notice, well, in this particular case, we only have a 1-carbon vitic reagent.
So that 1-carbon
is what formed the new alkene. Chop that alkene up, put a carbonyl there, that's what the original starting material was. The OH group was really there just to throw you off. Didn't do anything in this reaction. Next one.
What I think was the easiest problem on the final. Something reacts with this chiral secondary alcohol to make a chiral alkyl halide, but of reverse stereochemistry. And of course,
that's thionyl chloride.
Next one was a classic from a previous year. I either did this in class so you had warning, or you all scrambled to find a previous final somehow, because I was surprised how many of you got this right.
Because this is... what kind of functional group? It is an imine. It is a carbon-nitrogen double bond, which those come from aldehydes or ketones.
So open the structure up. It's another 5-carbon compound. Where the carbon-nitrogen double bond used to be, you have a carbon-oxygen double bond, but that nitrogen's part of the same molecule, so it doesn't just disappear. It's at the end. And since we had deuterium but not hydrogen, is ND2.
Why? Because there's no hydrogen. There's no hydrogen to get it from. You can't have NH2.
Something reacts with a Grignard reagent, a 3-carbon Grignard reagent, and methyl bromide. To make 3-methoxy-3-methylhexane. So, first thing to recognize is that the methyl group on oxygen came from the methyl bromide.
Because after a Grignard reaction, remember you have an alkoxide. If you throw alkyl halide at that before you do acid workup, you have an alkoxide, which means you could do a Williamson ether synthesis. So I don't know if we did anything sneaky like this for synthesis, but this is a perfectly legitimate trick. Well, so once we've accounted for that methyl group, we need to go back and look at the Grignard reaction part of it. So there's 3-carbon fragment that's been added on. So if we look at this,
here's those 3 carbons right here. So pull that out of the structure. What do we have left?
Butane-2-one. That has 4 carbons. The Grignard had 3. That gives us the 7 total, minus the methyl group that's on the oxygen.
2 more.
What's its name? Amazing how quickly it goes, isn't it? Anisole.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right, Dr. Green. You're right.
What can put an acyl group on there? Well, acylation.
Friedel-Crafts acylation, which uses acetyl chloride,
had to be the chloride, not an aldehyde. Technically, there are other functional groups that would work, but we're not going to learn about that until this quarter.
And with the acetyl chloride, you need either iron trichloride or aluminum trichloride, some strong kind of Lewis acid.
Now, the last reaction.
Something reacting with PCC, technically 2 equivalents, which means if you have 1 mole of starting material, you use 2 moles of PCC. The product was this, 4-hydroxy-3-oxo pentanal. PCC is an oxidizing agent. 2 equivalents were used. We have 2 carbonyls. So the original material was this. A triol.
Since there's PCC but no water, the primary alcohol was turned into an aldehyde. Regardless of conditions, the secondary alcohol turns into a ketone. And tertiary alcohol can't react. Questions? Then we are done for today. Please make sure you got your pre-lab for Wednesday.